Father, we just thank you this morning for an opportunity again to turn the pages of history to see a number of interesting and amazing things, and to see something today that, as we look later in our lesson, that perhaps some will feel a parallel with things that are going on in our day. But we have seen that quite a bit as we looked at history. We recognize that in many ways, what Solomon has said has proved itself to be true. There's nothing new under the sun. And yet we know that there are different shades of meanings and intentions on your part, none of which we really understand. And yet we look forward to the day when you will reveal it all to us. And yet now, as we can see through a mirror darkly, as it were, at some of your purposes and the unfolding of your plans, we do look forward to this time and pray that we make good use of it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. The two of the most important religious developments in the Catholic Church during Innocent III's reign were not Innocent's doing. The founding of two religious orders, the blank and the blank.
Franciscans.
And Dominicans. Franciscans and Dominicans, that's right. The Franciscan order was started by St. Francis of Assisi. And the Dominican order was started by
Dominique.
Dominique Guzman. You'll never forget his name, will you? Oh, that's so funny. Dominique, or Dominic, as I would have normally said it. Notice that the Albigensians, remember that heretical group in southern France primarily, notice the Albigensians' main attraction to their religious system was the asceticism of their leaders, which stood in contrast to the easy life of many Orthodox priests sent by the Pope to evangelize them. So, to win the heretics, which was his job at the time, Dominic went forth among them as a beggar, a poor man, barefoot and begging. Unlike the Franciscans, the Dominicans were from the very outset committed to scholastic theology. We look at all that. And they did indeed produce outstanding theologians. Most famously, who's one of the most famous Dominican scholastic, in fact, the most scholastic, famous scholastic theologian?
Martin Luther?
No. This is somebody we've already studied, not part of the Reformation. It's almost like he, what?
Augustine.
No, not Augustine.
That's who I was thinking, actually.
Scholastic theologian. Thomas Aquinas. You're going to go, oh, that's right.
That's going to be my next guess.
That was going to be the next guess. It was on the tip of his tongue. Not long after Innocent III's reign, two more important orders of friars came into being. What were they?
The Augustinians.
Augustinians and the... I hear somebody saying it?
Carmelites,
yes. The most famous Augustinian friar was to be...
Martin
Luther. All right, now you got it. You were ahead of your time, Andrew. Rather than withdrawing from society as the monks in monasteries had done, the mendicant orders, these Dominican and Franciscan orders, would go where and do what? Just generally.
Go out among the people and preach.
That's right. That's it. Go into society, preaching, winning disciples. They went into, and they also evangelized Muslims, pagans. And we're going to be looking at that today. The missionary expansion. So, there are various ebbs and flows in church history, and there are things that, you know, rise and things that fall. Missionary efforts are one of those things, and we have looked at missionary efforts in the past. We look at the a group that was looked at as somewhat as heretics. They really weren't. Yeah. Do you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry. And we look at their expansion. But it was not Roman Catholic expansion. That was a different kind of a subgroup that made quite a bit of headway going all the way across the East. We're going to see the Catholics made a similar expansion as well, and that's what we're going to be looking at today. So the Franciscans and Dominicans, that's why we took time to study them, get this background under our belt, were at the forefront of a new wave of Catholic missionary enterprise to Muslims and Mongols. These were the two missionary frontiers at this time. And of course, we spent a whole series of lessons looking at Muslims and their expansion and spread. And most of the efforts made towards Muslims that we've looked at have been more military than they have been evangelistic, right? But here we're going to see an actual evangelistic effort being made toward Muslims. After the pioneering work of Francis of Assisi and Raymond Lull, we talked about him a long time ago, we're looking at Muslim missionaries, other missionaries followed in their footsteps. So there were some early efforts on the part of St. Francis of Assisi and also a guy named Raymond Lull, looked at him a long time ago, you probably don't remember his name, and they made an effort to reach out to Muslims with some limited success. Another guy comes along, Spanish Dominican, Raymond of Pinafore. He evangelized Muslims in Spain and Northwest Africa from 1240 to 1275. So there's a whole sort of semicircular, if you can picture it on the map. I'm not going to put that map up right now, but you just picture in your mind Spain and kind of North Africa. That's the path the Muslims took in to Europe before they got stopped by Charles the Hammer in France. It was Raymond who persuaded Thomas Aquinas, the great scholastic theologian that you all are so familiar with, to write his Summa Contra Gentiles as a handbook for teaching Christianity to Muslims. So we look at that book and mentioned it as one of his great theological works where he talks about apologetics and the proof for the existence of God and things like that. And we're looking at it sort of theologically. It was actually written with the intention of being a practical handbook to help missionaries in the field talking to Muslims. So it actually had a practical purpose. It wasn't just mere academia taking place there. Another Dominican, William of Tripoli, tried to convince Pope Gregory X that he must abandon the crusade attitude towards Muslims and work for their peaceful conversion. Well, it's about time. You know. Although, again, the Muslims were, in a sense, military foes. They were like a dangerous foreign force. But some of the efforts were an attempt just to put them out of existence because they didn't like their beliefs. And this Dominican comes along to the Pope and says, look, let's try to evangelize these people, shall we? So William put his own theories into practice, working as a missionary in Palestine. Remember, that was the area where the Crusades were being sent to. That's where the Muslims were there. They drove them out, and then the Muslims came back in and drove the Europeans back out and kind of erased most of their efforts. So William puts his theories of evangelism to work, and he ends up baptizing 1,000 Muslims in the Palestine area. Not a place you would expect fruit, but there it was. Another Franciscan, Conrad of Ascoli, evangelized Muslims in Libya. Libya's still around. It's not a Christian country per se right now. But at this time, he's said to have baptized 6,000 Muslims. That's almost like Acts 2 territory there. The Dominicans and Franciscans each set up separate organizations called Society of Pilgrim Brothers, which sent out missionaries on a regular basis to different parts of the Muslim world. So there was a lot of effort to send missionaries to the Muslims, and as we're seeing, they met with a certain amount of success. Meanwhile, several Franciscan missionaries spearheaded Catholic evangelism among the pagan Mongols. Now, here's a different people group, and they're just basically pagans, but they were huge at this point in time. I'm going to show you how huge they were. This is over in Asia. This is where the Chinese and all that. We'll be looking at that in just a minute. So after emerging from Mongolia under Genghis Khan, how many people have heard of Genghis Khan? Everybody's heard of Genghis Khan for whatever reason. Khan is just a Mongolian word for ruler. After emerging from Mongolia under Genghis Khan in 1205, the Mongols created a vast empire which covered China, Central Asia, Persia and southern Russia. This is huge. I'm going to show you on a map in just a minute here how huge it is. And that's why everybody knows the name Genghis Khan, because he expanded in such a tremendous way. He conquered tremendous territory. These four regions were each governed by a Khan. As I said, that's the word for ruler. And the rulers of Mongolia and China were called the Great Khans. Wasn't there a Star Trek episode about Khan or something? I don't know. I'm not a super Trekkie fan, but I seem to remember that. The Mongols were merciless in war, but it is interesting, tolerant in religious matters once they conquered you. So once they had you under control, fine. You can talk to us about your religion. No biggie. And we're going to see, they liked entertaining religious discussion. It didn't always lead anywhere. But when it came to war, they were fierce, they were merciless, and they meant business. And if you were up against the Mongols, you were up against a force to be reckoned with, for sure. So there was clearly a mission here, field here for the Christianity and, by the way, for Islam. Remember, Islam is evangelistic as well for their beliefs. So the Christians and the Muslims are both trying to make some headway in this pagan territory because they don't have religious beliefs. Although, as we all know, everybody actually has religious beliefs, even if they don't say they do. And we're going to see that. So just to give you a little bit of an idea here, here's a map, a modern-day map of Eurasia. You know, you got China, and you got Russia, and you got Kazakhstan, and you've got over here, you've got Iran and Afghanistan and some of the Middle Eastern area that we're familiar with around the Persian Sea and so forth. So this orange, I don't know if you can see the orange outline here, but this covers how big the Mongol Empire got. It encompassed all of China, all of Russia, all of southern Russia, all of Mongolia, Kazakhstan, all that huge, that is a huge swath of area of land to dominate and control. And they did it. And from what I understand, they did it in fairly short order under Genghis Khan. There's a reconstruction from a museum of what a Mongol warrior might have looked like. Notice the sort of Asian look of the person in the saddle there, and the sort of the fierce look, all the weapons and armor, and got the arrows in the back there. Somebody that would have been somebody you didn't want to go up against too readily. Turn my left. Light off here, sorry. After I trip over a few cords, it makes it a little easier to see. Okay. The papacy and Latin kingdoms of the Middle East had great hopes of creating a military and political Catholic-Mongol alliance against the Muslim Turks. Now, the Catholics are always thinking strategically, militarily, almost as much, if not more so, than they are thinking evangelistically. And they're thinking, hey, can you imagine if we, you know, you just saw that big map. Can you imagine if we were able to dominate all of that area for Christianity and have a huge alliance against the Muslims? Against the Muslims? Wow. You can imagine the salivating over the prospect. So in 1246, Pope Innocent IV, I love that name, Innocent. This is not the Innocent. Innocent III is one of the major ones. This is his successor, apparently, or somebody who named himself. That's not necessarily his immediate successor. Anyways, Pope Innocent IV sent a Franciscan friar to the Mongol Great Khan Gyuk in present-day Mongolia. So the Pope says, you know, I like this idea. We ought to, these Franciscans are pretty good at evangelism. Let's send one of those guys over there and let him talk to the Great Khan. And see what happens here. Maybe you can talk some religion to him. Maybe we can make some progress here. Well, Gyuk treated the friar and his companions with great respect. So he didn't, you know, immediately kill him. But he had no intention of becoming a Christian. He was kind to him. He was respectful. He listened to what he had to say. Instead, Gyuk sent a message back to Innocent IV exhorting him and all Western Catholic rulers to submit to him as God's divinely appointed world leader. He said, you want a God? I'm it. Worship me. Next topic. That was the end of that. Okay. But it wasn't. In 1253, another Franciscan missionary, who was sent to Guyuk's successor, Mongka, met with a similar response. Again, Mongka treated the missionary well. The missionary stayed as a guest in the great Khan's court for 8 months, discussing religion with him and his couriers many times. So they sat around all day long having great religious and philosophical discussion. It wasn't like he had to just get up and do a Billy Graham thing and do a crusade and hope somebody, you know, came down and all that. He had long discussions over the whole deal. This is a friendship evangelism, right? Well, unfortunately, Mongka never converted to Christianity. In fact, Mongka expressed a typical Mongol attitude to religion when he told the missionary, I love this, listen to this, "We Mongols believe there's only one God in whom we live and die." Well, that's good, he's monotheist. "But as God has given different fingers to the hand, so he has given to mankind different ways to himself. To you Christians, he has given the Holy Scriptures. To us Mongols, he has given wizards and diviners." Does this sound familiar? Has anybody heard I hear this illustration used lots of times for lots of things. The illustration of the elephant and the blind men, right? And some people have said that, you know, they've used the analogy in terms of the religions of the world. The religions of the world, you know, are like the blind men feeling an elephant. One's feeling a tail and says it's long and skinny. One feels the ear and says big and floppy. Another feels the stomach and says it's high like a ceiling and so on. And they're all blind. They can't see that they're all looking at the same God. He looks different to different people, right? Or another one I've heard is that all the great theologians were climbing the mountain of theology, trying to get to the truth of God at the top. And when they all met at the top, they all found they were all seeking the same God. Right? That's that same idea that there's many ways to the same God. It's baloney. It's utterly in contrast to what the scriptures tell us. But it is a way that people today and people then and people throughout history have tended to look at things. Not everyone, of course. You got the Muslims who say, no, there's one God and yours is wrong, ours is right. You got that. But this is almost more like somebody would fit in well in our society, maybe, until you got to the sexual revolution. Then all of a sudden we're no longer just okay. But that's another story. Trade and commerce also played a part in opening up the Mongols to Catholic influence. So while they might not have been initially interested in Christianity and all the philosophical discussions, we can trade. We don't mind exchanging goods. And sometimes that's the way that the gospel travels on the back of economic trade. Interesting. That's what happened here. The great Mongol ruler, Kublai Khan, came in touch with Western Christianity through the travels of the Polo family. Does that sound familiar? Merchants of Venice, who were in China from 1260 to 1269, and again from 1275 to 1291, so several periods of time there. The most famous member was Marco Polo, who was in service of Kublai Khan throughout 1275 to 1291. Now, there's a household name for you, right? I understand there's an app for that now, Marco Polo. I've never used it. I have no idea how it works, what it does, but I just hear people talk about it. To me, Marco Polo was a game we played in a swimming pool. You guys ever do that? I don't know if people, you know, we'd close our eyes and somebody say, Marco, and you see other people, I'd say, Polo, and you got to try to go find him. Maybe that's how the Marco Polo app got started. I don't know. Somebody's swimming pool. After his return to Italy in 1292, Polo wrote an account of his travels in China. The English title is The Travels of Marco Polo, which revolutionized Western awareness of the East. I just can't help but... I'm falling so short of being able to present to you what his book had in it. It was fascinating what he wrote about, the things he discovered in China, the things that the people in the West had no knowledge of that were over there in the East, and it was a tremendous cultural exchange. I remember my wife was reminding me, actually, of one time about 30 years ago. There was a TV special on, and I think we didn't own a TV at the time, but I went down to where I was working, and they were going to let me watch it down there because we had TVs down there. And Anyway, we watched a special on Marco Polo. Paul, sounds like you saw it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. If you want to do some reading about the summary of his travels, or it's been put into video now and some of the things that they discover and so forth. Just, I can't help but, you know, want to say more about it, but our history is here would be prolonged, and I decided I can't afford that, so I encourage you to study that, look into it. Anyways, the result of this contact with the Polos, Kublai Khan in 1269 invited the West to send 100 Christian scholars to prove to Mongol scholars by just and fair argument that the faith professed by Christians is superior to any other based on more evident truth. I like that. So he's inviting missionaries. He's not there yet, but he's inviting missionaries anyways. That's a progress. And notice, again, it happened as a result of extended contact, of exchange of culture and of goods, in this case. Interestingly enough, the Catholic Church did not immediately take up the invitation. Maybe they were just kind of like, yeah, I've been there, done that. This doesn't go anywhere. Or maybe they had other things going on. I don't know why they didn't, but they didn't at first. But eventually, in 1289, that's like 20 years later, Pope Nicholas IV sent an Italian Franciscan missionary, is your Franciscan again, John of Montecorvino, to Kublai. But when John arrived in Peking in 1294, he found that Kublai had just died. Darn. So much for that opportunity. But maybe not. However, Kublai's successor, Timur, received John warmly. Okay, so the guy he went to see, who had invited the 100 Christian scholars 20 years earlier, had died while he was waiting for them to show up. They finally show up, and the successor's there, and so he receives him warmly. Okay, well, there you go. By 1305, John had baptized some 6,000 people. In 1307, Pope Clement V appointed him the first Catholic Archbishop of Peking. This is the sound of that. Sounds crazy today, doesn't it? Can you imagine having the Catholic Archbishop of Peking? Maybe there is one. I'm sure he's under strict control nowadays. John translated the New Testament and Psalms into the Mongolian language, which is interesting to me because the Catholic Church was so against putting the Bible in the language of the people, but in this case, the missionary did it, which was a good thing. Despite his initial success, however, the mission went into decline after John's death and was brought to an end in 1369 when the ethnic Chinese captured Peking from the Mongols. This is something else you see even in modern times. Sometimes a charismatic figure goes in and has a lot of success, and then nobody ever seems to be able to fill those shoes. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and maybe the success was built more on him, or maybe it was just the right time, and now it's not. I don't know. You wonder about things like that. Those are the things that God will show us maybe in the end, why all that happened. The Chinese, under their new Ming Dynasty, were anti-Christian and expelled all Westerners. Well, that sounds like the China we know today, or at least the Chinese government. This terminated all Christian missions in China for the next 200 years. So here you have this great success, and then, whew, gone. God works that way sometimes. God gives great success, and then God turns around in his providence and allows it all to go away in that place. He's building his church elsewhere at that point. The work of the Franciscan missionaries left no visible fruit behind. The majority of Mongols in the Far East drifted from their ancestral paganism into Buddhism, which has remained their ethnic religion to the present day. And that's why they're now mostly that. That's when it happened. The twists and turns of history, you know, who can understand them? Meanwhile, the Franciscan and Dominican missionaries had bigger fish to fry back home. They faced an equally destructive problem, the Black Death. And we're going to look at that in just a moment in more detail. This was a plague that swept through Europe from 1347 to about 1400. Under the devastating impact of the Black Death, the Franciscans and Dominicans found they simply could not keep up their supply of missionaries. They just couldn't keep up missionary efforts when at home everybody's dying off. And I'll explain that more in detail in a minute. As a result, the whole Catholic missionary program shrank to a tiny size. And the church did not effectively revive it for another 200 years. So this really put a kibosh on missionary efforts. Sometimes when you're struggling to survive, missions is not the first thing on your mind. So this brings us to the Great Plague. And it's really interesting. I was telling Kennard before, maybe some of you overheard me, but it almost looks like I timed this on purpose. I did not. I have been planning to teach this specific lesson for a long, long time. And it just worked out. And I thought was a great segue into it was that last statement. It was right out of the history book about the plague. I thought, well, what a great introduction to the plague. And lo and behold, here we are in a week where the stock market has taken another huge dive because of the panic over this coronavirus. And I have some statistics up here. I didn't try to make copies for everybody on the current death toll and the number of active cases and all that with countries around the world, kind of interesting stuff. Also, I've talked about some of the various pandemics that have swept the world in recent times. This is actually not the first here even. And then there have been many since. So we'll take a look at some of those. The Black Death, also known as the pestilence, or pest for short, the Great Plague, or the Plague, or less commonly, the Black Plague, had a lot of different names, was one of the most devastating pandemics in human history, resulting in the death of an estimated 75 to 200 million people in Eurasia, peaking in Europe in 1347 to 1351. Now you think about that. The world population was not near as big back then as it is now. We've got about 7.5-8 billion people on the earth today. At the time, there was less than 500 million people on the earth. 400 and something million, at the highest end. It might have been 300 and something million. So you got up to 75, 200 million people dying. That is huge. That is huge. I mean, the stock market crashed. And, you know, the United States has 69 cases of flu and one death. You know, I know, maybe not a fair comparison, but even in China, which, you know, they're more worried about covering up the flu than they are, you know, helping people get well from it. And they've had a lot of deaths. They've had 2,800 deaths, 2,870 as of today. A total of 80,000 out of a total of 80,000 cases of the flu. This is current statistic, just pulled off the internet this morning. So just put it in perspective, okay? It's nothing like this. Okay. Now it may get there. I don't know. I doubt it personally. I don't think this is going to go there, but no one knows. I guess. So there you go. What caused the plague? Well, it was caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, which results in several forms of the plague, which they believe that was the cause. And the Black Death was the first major European outbreak of the plague. The plague created a number of religious, social, and economic upheavals with profound effects on the course of European history. No kidding. I mean, you have that many people dying, it's going to have a huge effect, and it did. The Black Death is thought to have originated in the dry plains of East or Central Asia, i.e. China. Another irony, right? All plagues start in China. No, they don't. But, you know, our current plague, if you will call it that, our current virus started in China. And this plague actually is thought to have been started in China, where it traveled along the Silk Road. Anybody know what the Silk Road is? I read a whole book called The Silk Roads. Great book, by the way. Kind of liberal, but I still like it. Yeah, that was the roads that people traveled because they were trading the East for silks. And they were trading all the stuff from the West. There was a lot of trade going on. It was a trade route, basically. And disease travels along trade routes. Disease traveled with people and rats, as we will see. From there, it most likely was carried by fleas living on black rats that traveled on all merchant ships spreading throughout the Mediterranean basin and Europe. Again, they had no clue. They didn't even know about germ theory. They didn't know virtually anything that we know today about disease and what causes disease. They didn't know what bacteria was. It was just mysterious, which makes it all the more scary, right? I mean, at least you could say, well, there's these little microbes and they're spreading and they come on the rats and watch out for rats. They didn't know any of that. They just like people just start dying all of a sudden in massive numbers. Massive number. This is huge. Suddenly, with no apparent reason, this is how it looked to them, people began developing strange symptoms that usually began with a fever. Well, you know, people have fevers all the time. Leads to a loss of balance, okay? Produced enormously swollen lymph nodes, which most disease does, accompanied by symptoms of dementia. By the fifth day, most of those who developed these symptoms were dead. Now that was scary. You know, like a flu thing or something, and they got this disease, and, you know, they're sick or whatever, and then they're dead. And lots and lots and lots of people were dying. Between 1348 and 1350, the plague swept the entire continent. So this is giving you an idea here, and, you know, we won't spend forever, but it basically, it starts over here in China, and, you know, the Caspian Sea area maybe, spreads over here, and then from the Black Sea, it kind of comes down here and loops its way around and loops its way up, and basically goes all the way through North Africa, through the Middle East, through all of Europe, all of Scandinavia. I mean, it's going everywhere and wiping people out in droves, massive numbers. Black Death is estimated to have killed 30 to 60% of Europe's population. Can you imagine that? I mean, 10% is huge, right? If such a disease were to come about to do that. 60%? If it was that high? That's the majority of people dying. In total, the plague may have reduced the world population from an estimated 475 million, that's a high estimate for world population at the time, to 350, 375 million in the 14th century. It took 200 years for Europe's population to recover its previous level in some regions. And in some regions like Florence, it took till the 19th century to recover. And this is not something you can just turn around and recover from. The plague recurred as outbreaks until the early 20th century. So we're talking about a major outbreak, and then it kind of died down. But periodically, it would revive again, and it would start again, and then it would die down. But the later outbreaks weren't quite as severe, presumably because people have built immunities in previous outbreaks. Because what they noticed about later outbreaks is more young people were dying who hadn't developed immunities yet. So now it's like a disease that attacks the young. That's even more scary. The plague had far-reaching consequences. Economically, all Europe was disrupted. Entire markets disappeared. I mean, you talk about a stock market crash. this is another level altogether. With such large population decline from the plague, wages soared in response to labor shortage. Now, think about that. That's an interesting phenomenon. There's nobody to work anymore. You need somebody, and everybody's needed everywhere. And so people are like, hey, I'm needed in five different places. How much are you going to pay me to help you? Right? This causes wages to increase. And it's kind of like when the price goes up on a product in the supermarket. Have you ever noticed this? You know, there's a sugar shortage, and all of a sudden the price is short. I think sugar's done this about 10 times in my lifetime. My wife always complains about this. She said, I noticed there's a shortage, and so the price goes way up. And she said, it never comes back down. It's like it stays up. Have you noticed that? That's what happened to wages. So, if you want to increase wages, you don't need a union, you need a plague. Just kidding. But it was one of the interesting side effects of the plague was it raised the standard of living for the poor people. Interesting side effect. It would take Europe several centuries to find a measure of demographic and economic stability, as you might imagine. The plague also had enormous religious consequences. And you think about this. In the subsequent outbreaks, those who died were mostly the young who had not developed any immunity. I mentioned this a minute ago. So it seems to some people that death had come to prefer younger victims, which is even more horrible. They're killing our children. The nature of the disease itself, which attacked people who seemed perfectly healthy, led to many to doubt the rationally ordered universe of earlier generations. So there's nothing makes sense about life anymore. You expect old, sick people to die. But young, healthy people are dying? Why, Lord? What's going on? Does anything make sense? Among intellectuals, this led to doubts regarding the ability of reason to grapple with the mysteries of existence. I mean, this had philosophical ramifications, and people just began to doubt themselves. What is life? What is it all about? I don't get it. Among the general populace, it encouraged superstition. It's just like, who knows? Who knows? Weird stuff happened. Since death always seemed imminent, people began to live their lives in preparation for it, I imagine. Many went on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land or to Rome or someplace. Those who were too poor to take these journeys and go on pilgrimages went to local shrines. This is when the veneration of relics, you know, the bones of the apostles, all that kind of stuff, the Catholic councils had made that sort of, they tamped it down and made it illegal, but the people were saying, we need something, we need something. That's where all the superstition started. Maybe if I touch these bones, I'll get well. I don't know, I need something. Fear was everywhere. Fear of the plague, fear of hell, fear of the supreme judge, whom many were having to face sooner than expected. Scary prospect. This was a sad outflow, and so typical, unfortunately. Why this keeps happening to the Jews, those poor Jews. For many Jews, the plague brought death by violence instead of the disease itself. I said, what? How'd that happen? Christians could not understand why the plague seemed to make less headway in Jewish neighborhoods. Fact. The Jews did not get the plague as much as other people. Why is that? Anybody know? That might be a guess, and this is just a guess, but this is not the guess of the experts. Today, some suggest there were more cats and fewer rats in those areas because Christian cats have been associated with witchcraft. You know, even today, Halloween, what's one of the icons of Halloween? The black cat, right? The Christians kind of thought of cats as scary, and when they're superstitious, they don't want them around. But the cats, the Jews didn't have that superstition. The cats were fine. The Jews were cat lovers. They kept the rats down, and so they didn't get the disease, which the rats were the carriers of the disease. So here's a shout out for cat lovers. Y'all can bask in your cat glory. Who knew? Who knew? And they didn't know. They didn't see that connection. We can picture that now because we know the cause. Whatever the case, at the time of the plague, some came up with a simple explanation, the simplistic explanation, that Jews had poisoned the wells from which Christians drank. That's the Jews that are causing this. They're the ones that did it. The result was violence and massacre. It was a time of fear, and fear demanded its victims. It's just, the ugly ironies of history. Ugly ironies. Well, a lot more could be said, but I just wanted to give you that exposure. Next week, we're going to look at the Western Schism, kind of a cartoonish picture there, of Avignon, which is in France, in Rome. Two popes fighting for the scepter of Christianity. Ended up being three popes in the end. At one point, Christianity had three popes, simultaneous popes, that's the word I'm looking for, all at the same time. Who's the real pope? And the Catholics have fun explaining that one today, you know, with their line of popes and all that jazz. This kind of makes a mess out of that theory. But of course, you know, they always have a way of trying to get around it. But anyhow, it's interesting study and what happens. So we're going to look at that next week and probably some other things. I have several other very interesting topics left before we finish up the Middle Ages, which shouldn't be too much longer. Snacks. We have Miss Sandy brought the snacks this morning, and we need a volunteer for next week. Por favor. Anybody? Okay, we'll pick on the Michons. Thank you. I had two hands at once, and I think maybe you brought us to say, so let's go. Thank you, Michons. All right, discussion time. Couple suggested questions. We talked today about the significant Christian evangelism that took place in the 13th and 14th centuries, 1200, 1300s, and the thousands of baptisms that followed, right? We have also been looking in recent lessons at how much theological distortion of the gospel has taken place in centuries prior to this. You know, purgatory and indulgences and relics and all this stuff where you begin to go, do they really understand the gospel? In light of that, how should we view the evangelism that was taking place? Were people truly being saved, or was this just a spread of dead Roman Catholic religion? I brought that up because my wife, I mentioned in a previous lesson about the spread of the gospel, and my wife asked, spread of the gospel or spread of the Roman Catholic religion? So, let you play with that a little bit. Second possible question. The Great Plague was, by almost any measure, a horrible disaster. Yet one good that came of it was that people became acutely aware of the certainty and imminence of death and the Day of Judgment. Do you think that due to the relative safety and good health that we enjoy in our society, coronavirus notwithstanding, do you think that you tend to live your life, practically speaking, as though you'll never die? Is that a bad thing? And if so, is there anything you should do to change the way you're living? Now, as always, my questions have a two-edged sword, right? And it may look like I'm pushing in one direction, but you know me well enough to know that I'm actually always putting you on the horns of a dilemma. That's part of the discussion idea. And of course, you can come up with an equally great question, or you're certainly welcome to do so. Okay. So anyhow, anybody want to tackle one of those or some other question? Yes.
I have a comment on
okay.
the fact that the Jews didn't get the plague.
Yeah.
There's diets based on how God told the Jews to eat.
Yeah.
And based solely on the fact that they did not get it, because the thinking is their immunities were so good because of the way they ate that they didn't get it. They were exposed to it, but never got sick from it because they were so healthy. And now there's the books on the Bible diet and all this stuff to get mm-hmm. you to eat that way just to be healthy.
Well, all I can tell you is I've known people who had great diets. In fact, it seems to me like the people who are most diet conscious are the ones who are most sick. That's been my personal experience. I don't know about you. You just do a register in your own mind and see what you think about that. I don't know. I mean, that sounds like you're liking that and leaning towards that. That I just told you what the experts thought, and it was spread by rats, and I don't care what you were eating. I think if you got exposed, you were going to get sick, and a certain percent of the people who got sick died from it. So I don't know. I have to say, ultimately, we don't know. But
well, you said yourself that the children were vulnerable.
Yes.
The community. I think Andrea's point could be a factor, because your general overall health as an individual. I mean, if you're living in the Middle Ages in the slums of the city, you might have more susceptibilities for more reasons than one to getting some disease.
Y'all remember that Christian missionary 2 years ago that got Ebola? And when they brought him home, they didn't give him medicine. They just got him clean. His own body built up the white blood cells or whatever that was necessary to fight off that bacteria. And
I mean, in some of these city environments, they threw out their bathroom stuff into the streets. I mean, it was...
Yeah, they had no sense of germs.
The sanitation of this time period in many of these places was very, very poor. That can only have contributing factors. Right now, the great spread through the rats, I mean, that's the origin. But then the conditions can be other factors are at play with the conditions in which you contract the source.
But I'll point out, again, the young got it.
Yeah.
The young were presumably eating about the same diet as the adults. Why did the young not get it? What do they think? They hadn't had immunities. Okay. How do we give ourselves immunities to disease? The dreaded vaccination. Ta-da! Now I've really thrown you. Now everybody's going to really want to fight about that one. All right. Well, what we're really doing, though? We're talking, we're actually illustrating point two, I think, maybe.
Well, on point one, in a previous lesson, we talked about soldiers and whether their mission is for the spread of democracy or the spread of Christianity, because good results from both, in a way. And I could see how the spread of this Catholicism with whatever form of morality and good works were associated with it, it could bring about some positive influence, but if it's not the gospel, it's not an eternal impact. It's more of a societal impact. And I don't know if that's towards the question that you're asking here.
It is. Although
we should think the same way when it comes to wanting to raise our kids to be polite, to open the door, yes sir, yes ma'am, to be gentlemen and ladies. That's not teaching them to be Christians. It's just teaching them to be good citizens. In the same way, what we're probably seeing in some of these missionary efforts was not so much a spread of the gospel as it was a spread of a certain standard.
Okay, let's graph that. But are people being saved?
Depends on who is preaching the message and what message is being preached. It depends on the missionary.
Right. I would say that we don't know. I have a lot of concern based on the theology I know developed. But I also know God builds His church, and I'm going to say God has built His church and kept it somewhere at all times. And it doesn't always look like His church looks the pristine church that we want to see today. Sometimes it deviated to some degree. How far can it deviate before it's no longer the... Well, you know, it gets a little dicey there to try to figure that out. But, I mean, I have been tempted in time past. I remember a great... well-known history teacher came to the Bible church to give a lesson on church history years ago, and I had a chance to go up afterward and have a private conversation. And I said, you know, people always say that the gospel is going away in Luther's time, and that's why the Reformation was needed to bring the gospel back, which is true. I said, it seems to me like they lost the gospel around 1,000 or 1,200. He said, no. He didn't agree with that. Well, that's just his opinion. But he makes a point, which is, you know, are you gonna say that the church completely vanished from the earth? Of course, we know about the Waldensians and stuff. Some people want to go in the direction of the small groups that we don't know anything about. That's where the real church was. Maybe.
Your experience in the Catholic Church, I've got some Catholic friends, one in particular that's in my mind, who attends Catholic services and goes through all that, but I believe them to be a Christian. Based on our conversations in the gospel. Now, he's obviously got a lot of baggage in church tradition and muddled additions to that. So I'm just wondering that if a attendee of a Catholic church follows everything that their leadership says, they might not be a Christian. But it's possible that they're attending that because that's where they were raised, that's just their community.
What they married into.
But that if you get to some specifics, you find out they love the Lord and yeah. they understand their sin. They are trusting in Christ.
Yeah, you know, to that point, I mean, I have met Catholics, even recently, that they're Catholics, so I tend to think they're not Christian. I certainly want to get them out of their Catholicism. But in talking to them, I'm almost wondering they might be a Christian because I start asking about the gospel and they give good answers. I'm not in a position to say that they're condemned. Maybe they're saved in spite of their Catholicism, and that's what might have been going on during those centuries. I just bring that up because maybe as you're listening to this and you're thinking, yeah, the church spread, so what? You know, a bunch of Catholics, who cares? And I don't think we should look at it that way. I think we should recognize and be concerned about the errors of Catholicism, especially today. They've been amplified 100-fold from what they were then, and they, you know, because it continued to amplify. But I don't know that I would say they weren't saved. I would just say they probably had a lot of error, and we probably have a lot more error than we realize. I know we do. We've got to. So something to think about.
Yes. Are you saying that you think within church history, in the Catholic Church that we've been going through, that you think that the gospel was alive, at least in part, in Christian or Catholic history?
I think so.
Okay, I'll buy that.
I think that's...
So actually what you're doing is you're separating. Instead of taking the religion as a whole, you're separating and say those that actually believe in the gospel, yet call themselves Catholic and part of it, they're still saved Christians.
That's right.
All right, I'll buy it.
And I've met people in all kinds of churches that normally I say, you know, Church of Christ, not saved. You know, I believe you have to be baptized to be saved. That's the worst gospel. They're not saved. They're going to hell. You know, well, if they believe all that, truly. But what if there's some who, in spite of what they're taught, they somehow, God worked in their heart to grab on most tenaciously to the real gospel, and the other stuff is sort of window dressing to them. They're not really as wedded to it as, you know, I don't know. God's going to sort that all out in the end. So it gives us a little hope. We should be concerned. We don't want to just blow it off and say, oh, yeah, everybody can be saved. But at the same time, we don't want to assume just because somebody takes a label that they're automatically, yep, burning in hell. You know, you just don't know.
Let me just quickly give thought to your second question. I think that we don't talk about death enough. I think that a lot of people live as if they'll live forever here on this earth. I think, you know, working in a law firm, I can say that, that there are lots of folks out there who haven't thought through estate planning. They don't have a will. They haven't given any thought to what happens if they die. They haven't prepared their spouse. And if they die, their spouse is like, you took care of the bills. You took care of everything. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
And I think a very deliberate approach should be to have regular conversations about these things. And not only to, not just funeral planning, but even more extensive than that.
That's a good word, especially from the perspective of your work experience. I can see that makes a lot of sense. The point I made a while ago, I said this is an illustration possibly of point two. It's my suspicion that our obsession with eating the perfect food and all that stuff is because we think we're going to live forever. We're not. We are simply not. Now, that doesn't mean you couldn't have better health. Doesn't mean you might not live longer. Doesn't mean you shouldn't worry about what you eat. Don't get me wrong. But maybe we're just a little bit obsessed sometimes because somehow we think we're going to live forever. We're not. So something to think about, I think. Yeah. All right. Last word, Andrea. For better or for worse, we're going to give you the last word.
The way we live affects the amount of time we live.
The way we live affects my... Yeah, I think humanly speaking, of course, obviously in the sovereignty of God, no. No. But in terms of, you know, like sovereignty of God, if I want to walk out in the middle of the freeway and I don't get run over, you know, God can sovereignly keep that from happening. It's just not a good idea. So there's statistically, you know, what makes sense, and then there's, yeah. So I don't know if I answered your question or not. From humanly speaking, yeah. But again, no matter how much you live the perfect life, the perfect diet, the perfect exercise, you put it on whatever you want on the list, sooner or later, as D.A. Carson says, something's going to kick you in the teeth if you live long enough. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you're going to die. Everybody will.
Well, our pastor that was killed, he ate right, he swam every day, all this, and his wife even said he did all this, and this idiot hits him on the road. So
yeah.
It's like, well, God's timing, it doesn't matter what you do.
That's true. That's
God's
absolutely true.
To take you, he's going to.
Question of all right. You're doing what you're doing. I actually take the opposite approach. Lindsay will tell you, on any given day, I'm probably dying of something. So.
All right, now I got to wrap us up here, folks. And my wife's going to come out with the kids and go, I told you. All right. Father, thank you for this discussion, this time. A lot of good thought here, a lot of ideas to contemplate. We do thank you for this opportunity that history has given us to look at these things. Give us wisdom, Lord. Keep us humble and keep us committed to your word and to you in all things. Christ's name we pray, amen. You're dismissed.